The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports, if I can get my lips to work. Sorry about that start. We all have lip problems sometimes. All right, first person from the Reader's Digest, Finding My Funny. And there's a picture here of an African-American woman, very attractive. I got her hair all up top with a big red bandana on and eyelashes that might be 6 inches long. And from the time she was a little girl, lonely love has always gone for laughs. A comedian learns that the best stand-up is the kind you do for yourself. Claire Lemoore pushed her gray out of her eyes. "Lonely," she said, "you're killing me." Her words hit me like a punch in the belly. I had graduated from college with an engineering degree and was working at Xerox, but I'd always dreamed of a career in comedy, so I enrolled in Claire's comedy class. "So you wanted to stand up?" According to her website, Claire was a world-renowned teacher of comedy arts. Now she was telling me in front of the class that my comedy just wasn't any good. "Can I try again?" I asked. "No," Claire answered, motioning me off the stage. "Give somebody else a turn. You can try again next week." I paid $300 for 6 weeks of lessons at a showcase where students perform in front of a live audience at a Hollywood comedy club. To me, the showcase alone was worth the money. All I wanted to do was get on stage. After all, I had killed at the highly competitive Brewster Douglas Houston Project's Junior Talent Show when I was 9. A few years later, I got some of the best laughs at the Prairie View Student Center had ever seen with my one-woman Wanda Winfrey talk show. While I was in college, I used to do the open mic contest at a local bar. I'd get on stage, talk about college life and my roommate's latest shenanigans, and win that prize money every time. The first time I performed in front of Claire, I had given her what I thought was a solid joke about take your kids to work day. Who came up with this idea? People go to work to leave their kids. In the break room at Xerox, my coworker Bob had laughed so hard that his Diet Pepper came out of his nose. But comedy expert Claire LeMonro didn't even crack a smile. "The problem with your material," she said, "is it just doesn't feel authentic." I wasn't sure what Claire meant, but I understood there was a lot different ways to be funny. Richard Pryor forced his audience to confront uncomfortable truths, like racism. Jerry Seinfeld specialized in making funny observations about everyday life. And Joan Rivers' best jokes involved putting herself down. I knew I wasn't raw or edgy, and I didn't want to shock or offend. I wanted my comedy to be a reflection of myself, warm, easygoing. I wanted to be the kind of performer who you'd see on stage and think, "I'd like to invite her over for a fun night of drinking cocktails and taking pics from my Tinder profile." Most of all, I wanted to make jokes about the world I saw around me, like the crazy things happened at work every day. The next Tuesday, I tried my material again. "Have you ever noticed how people who work in offices decorate the cubicles?" I began. Wait, stop right there," Claire said, putting her hands up like traffic. "What are you doing right now?" This felt like a quick question. "I'm doing comedy." No. What are you talking about? Is this supposed to be some kind of Seinfeld bit? You know, like, what's the deal with chickens, with cubicles? Claire did a pretty good Seinfeld. I think what an audience wants from you is more personal, more of you speaking from your own experience. "This is my experience," I said. "I work in an office." No, she continued. "I mean, give them something like more unique and authentic. Like, where did you grow up?" "Detroit." "Okay, that's good. Give me more of that. What kind of a neighborhood was it?" "The hood." "I love that. Tell me more." "I grew up in the projects." "Fantastic. But I work in an office. I'm an engineer." "Lonely, everybody works in an office. We want your unique experience. In the hood. Were there drug dealers? Drive-bys? Give me some of that gritty, hard, scrabble life you lived." I wanted to declare that I didn't know anything about selling drugs or drive-bys. I wanted to tell her I played the French horn when I was a kid. But she was on a roll, and I couldn't get a word in edgewise. "Do you have any stories about crack? Dealing crack, maybe? Smoking crack? Like maybe you dabbled in the crack?" I stared at her blankly. "Okay," she said. "Let's try this again. Show me what you've got." I cleared my throat and gave it another shot. "So, I work at Xerox," I said, my voice trembling with nerves, "and I was in my cubicle." Claire just shook her head. I didn't want to mess up in front of the whole class again. I had to think fast and save my joke. I reached under my desk, I contended, and I pulled out some crack. Week after week, Claire directed me to keep it real, by which she meant talk about my life in the hood. By the second to the last class, I had saw a 5-minute set sealed with F-bombs. "Lonely," Claire said, "this is so raw, I love it." Claire was happy because I'd taken her notes to put some sassy black girl in it and represent it like a girl from the hood. But the truth was, even though Claire liked my jokes, to me they never felt right. As proud as I was of my roots, I didn't want to talk about my past like this. The hood, my mama, ketchup sandwiches, being poor, the crack epidemic, it was all part of a world I'd worked hard to escape. I didn't think it was funny when I was living among crack dealers and cockroaches, and I didn't want to turn that life into jokes now that I was out. Besides, I didn't think I had to. If Seinfeld could make a career commenting on everyday stuff he noticed all around him, why couldn't I? The night of our graduation showcase, I drove to the comic club and felt like bats flying around in my stomach. When the lights went down, I stood in the back and watched my classmates perform. Annabelle was up first. For 5 minutes, she complained about dating, bad food, bad company, bad dates. Then Juan Carlos went up. He got some good laughs about wearing slippers with socks. Then it was my turn. On my way to the stage, Juan Carlos grabbed me by arm. "Do you, girl," he whispered. "Claire don't know your life. That Cuba routine was dope." His words stopped me dead in my tracks. Sometimes people are put in your life to tell you exactly what you need to hear. Like when a man in a crisp white dress shirt approaches you on the General Motors assembly line and suggests you go to college, as my first mentor, Mr. Arnold, had for me. There was another one of those times. For 6 weeks, Claire had said, "Be authentic. Find your voice." But I didn't really get it until Juan Carlos whispered in my ear. If I wanted to be authentic and real, I had to do what felt right to me. I stepped on stage with the spotlight shining bright in my face and my heart beating through my chest. "My name is Lonnie Love," I said, looking at the crowd. 100 faces peered back at me expectantly. This was my moment to choose my truth over reality someone else assumed for me. This was the fork in the comedy road. "I'm an engineer," I began, "and I work in a building with rows and rows of cubicles. Everybody tries to outdo everyone else decorating the cubicle. My co-worker Carol has pictures of ugly old family members all up around her cubicle. Nobody wants to see that. It's just rude. Now I try to be nice to my co-workers. In my cubicle, I have my computer and a little radio. You know what else I have under my desk?" I paused, looked around the room, and smiled. "I got me a George Foreman grill." For 5 minutes, I talked about office life, my office life, cooking chicken at my cubicle, teaching my white co-workers black history. When I finished my set, I got a standing O. I learned an important lesson that night. Claire, the supposedly comedy expert, didn't know a thing about me or what I could do on stage. All Claire knew is what I looked like. For her, that was enough to decide who I should be. Claire was the first industry expert to try to mold me to fit her expectations. But she sure wasn't the last. Fighting other people's assumptions is a challenge I've had to face for most of my career. I'm hardly alone. No matter who you are or where you go in this life, people are going to try to put you in a box. Once they put you there, they're going to try to convince you that it's the best place for you. But if they are wrong about you, you've got to stand up and let them know it. In comedy and in life, you can't expect people to give you permission to be yourself. You have to mark on stage, claim your space, tell your story, and live your truth. If you don't do it, who will? And with that, this is something a little less heavy. And this is a note from Judy Rolano, who is the deputy editor for Reader's Digest. Apparently the regular editor has retired. "A long road home. When I was a little girl growing up in Anamosa, Iowa, my favorite thing to do was read, same as today. So when I thought about what I wanted to be when I grew up, I'd figure I'd be a librarian, our town librarian. Mrs. Tone was really important to me becoming me. The library had a 2-book limit, but she knew I'd blow through those in just a few days. She always let me check out a big stack. When I was in the 4th grade, our school librarian, Mrs. Kettleson, sent some poems I'd written about dinosaurs to Highlights Magazine. My first published writing. At the University of Iowa, majoring in journalism, I quickly learned I did not want to be a newspaper reporter. I'm shy about interviewing people, which is usually almost everyone who knows me and thinks I'm outgoing. I am, but only with people I know. So I was thrilled when I was selected for a summer internship at Reader's Digest. 10 years after that, I came back to R&D to work as an editor. I've worked at other magazines, too, but I spent most of my career here, reading magazines, newspapers, websites, and books for stories we could condense, writing articles, even choosing jokes. This usually seemed like the perfect one to introduce myself to you all. The Tractor War, on page 92, which we'll read later, takes me home to the Midwest. Something to Sneeze At, page 47, reminds me of all the sneezing I did when I moved to New York City and was suddenly allergic to grasses and trees. Pet Besties, page 58, makes me think about my cats, brothers Reggie and Smokey, who are sitting together at the window as I write. I relate to lots of our stories this month, and I hope you do too. Enjoy. And there's a picture of her in her little hand-pedal tractor rolling down the sidewalk in her childhood home. Letters to the editor. Notes on the July-August issue. The best dessert in every state. Oh, boy, this story made my mouth water. But as a Marylander for 74 years, I've never had a German cookie. The best treat is a Smith Island cake, which the state legislature made Maryland's official dessert. Get the Taste of Home crew to try one of those, and you might never leave the state. The Snake Charmers. Great article on a group of women helping to curtail invasive Burmese pythons in the Florida Everglades. What's missing is how those snakes got there in the first place. My guess is owners brought them home for their scary cool factor, then dumped them in the wild after the people grew bored or the snakes got too big. With no native predators, the python reproduced and created this problem, and that's a fact. The 100 funniest tweets ever. To keep my sense of humor during the pandemic, I ordered every Reader's Digest humor book I could find. I read a few pages every day until I made it through the entire collection. Your article, The 100 Funniest Tweets Ever, made me laugh so hard I couldn't catch my breath. I usually recycle the issue or give it to someone else, but this one I had to keep and periodically read a few tweets to put a smile on my face. And that's from Michelle Fitzpatrick in Goose Creek, South Carolina. Everyday Heroes. I enjoy reading about the street vet who treats homeless people's pets. Our animals don't care if we live in a mansion or on the street. They only want to be loved and be taken care of the best we can. If we were more like our pets, the world would be a much better place to live. It's Michael Wilson, Marshall, Illinois. Quotable quotes. Yo-Yo Ma said in part, "The pandemic accentuated part of me that says why I'm useful. I have a chronic migraine, and when I feel one hitting, it's a hot shower and Yo-Yo Ma's renditions of the greats that help. I can almost see him in front of me, bow in hand, sweating my pain out with every slide across the strings. The way before any pandemic, I knew his value, and hope he does too." Amanda Lowry from Savannah, Georgia. We found a fix. You mentioned sprinkling cornstarch on your legs to more easily brush sand off them at the beach. I carry a paintbrush for the very same use. I give my chair, toys, coolers, bag, and feet a good dusting before getting in the car. I get strange look, but it works. DS via email. 13 things. I think Idaho's Bruno Dunes State Park should be among your mentions of America's grandest and most notable sand dunes, as it features the tallest freestanding dune in North America. Melvin McKenzie, Mountain Home, Idaho. A World of Good. What the Conservation Fund did for the residents of Browns Mill Park, creating a community farm where anyone in need can pick up fruits and vegetables for free, is a possibility for every town. Let's spread the ideal. Behat Desa, East Longmeadow, Massachusetts. A happy medium. I had to respond to your article about feeling happy even when you're not. I have a mantra. Out of bed, out of your head. Easier said than done. But once I give my time and energy to others, I feel happy. Terry Mills, Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. I listen to the Happiness Hour radio show and find his philosophy works. I smile a lot and never answer how are you with a litany of problems. Think about how many people answer with just fine when they're not at all. Aha! You agree with our philosophy. Tony Kellers, Percasa, Pennsylvania. Parents don't pass down genes. They pass down all kinds of habits, traditions, and expectations of what it means to be good or not so good parent. What carryovers from your childhood have shaped you how you raise your own kids? Are you as Xbox-averse as your dad was to Atari? Do you make sure your kids finish the season before giving up a sport since your mama didn't raise a kidder? Tell us and see our terms at rd.com/parenting, and we might use your story in an upcoming issue. And the next article is Everyday Heroes, Furnishing Hope. For extra foster children to have a seat at the table, first they need a seat at the table. And there's a picture of a young woman, attractive, sitting on the back end of a box truck with furniture in the background. For Maria Papella's clients, new furniture means one less thing to worry about. Hannah Lezecki was weeks away from having a baby, and the only furniture she had in her Cleveland, Ohio apartment was a crib and an air mattress with a hole in it. I had to keep waking up in the night and fill it, she said. 1 year before, at age 18, she had aged out of foster care. Having been in the system since she was 4 when her single mother was no longer able to care for her, Lezecki was now enrolled in college, hoping to become a detective. She received a stipend from a state program that helps former foster kids care kids attending college. Still, niceties such as furniture just weren't in her budgets. Then she learned about Charity, and that's Chair/ITY, a nonprofit formed by 24-year-old Maria Paparella. The Cleveland-based organization provides furniture and household goods to young adults who have left foster care. When Lazieski reached out to Charity, Paparella asked what she needed. Everything, she replied. She left it to Paparella to figure out what everything was. Lazieski wasn't home when the furniture arrived. Her mother let the movers in, but she walked into an apartment with her two-day-old baby boy, she gasped. In the once-empty apartment stood a full kitchen set, a bed, a dresser, two end tables, a desk, and a burgundy armchair with a footstool for nursing. I was like, wow, they gave me all of this, Lazieski says. I was already stressed out about being a single mom. It relieved me of a lot. Lazieski's story isn't unusual. There are about 424,000 children in foster care in the United States. Every year, around 20,000 young adults, at least age 18 or 21, depending on the state, age out of the system, often without the support of a trusted adult to go for life advice or furniture hand-me-downs. Paparella first became aware of foster care in elementary school when her parents were considering adopting a child. The plan didn't work out, but Paparella often found her thinking about that girl. I'm really close with my family, and I couldn't imagine being completely on my own at 18, she says. At 16, Paparella visits Sumba County Children's Service in Akron, Ohio, with a list of questions, trying to understand what aging out looked like. One of her questions was, what's not being met for these young people? Near the top of the list was furniture. That struck home, she says, Paparella. The idea of moving into an apartment, not having a bed to sleep on or a sofa to sit on, that pulled at my heartstrings. Paparella contacted her parents' friends, asking if they had spare furniture to donate. A local furniture store, Chesdale Interiors, offered free warehouse space in its delivery truck. Social workers provided referrals. In between lacrosse games and college applications, Paparella, with her dad's help, added furniture delivery person to her resume. Watching the recipients' faces when they receive a bed, a couch, whatever, was transformational. Paparella remembers delivering a gold lamp to a woman and watching her polish it lovely, getting rid of smudges and fingerprints. To think that this thing that hadn't been thought about in years now brought so much happiness to somebody was amazing, Paparella says. Today, Charity has given furniture to nearly 200 young adults in homes across six Ohio counties. As word has gotten out, Paparella has received donations from people who have brought new furniture and want to get rid of their old pieces, people who are moving, people who have heard of her work on social networking sites. She's convinced these contributions give the recipients hope and confidence. Lazieski agrees. Finding her baby on the nursing chair, feeding her baby on the nursing chair, or changing him at his dressing table gives her a sense of security. It makes me feel like I'm no different from other parents. My whole life I felt abnormal, she says. Now I feel normal. The Breath of Life by Andy Simmons. As a 17-year-old Toriel Norwood drove through St. Petersburg, Florida last February, the laughter and chatter from her four teenage girls inside her car quickly gave way to screams. As they approached an intersection, another car T-boned them, sending their black sedan sailing into a yard of nearby home, coming to a stop only when it crashed into a tree. As smoke billowed from the other car, a bystander shouted, "It's about to blow up! Get out!" The impact had caved in Norwood's driver's side door, jamming it shut. Shaken, but otherwise okay, she crawled out through the window. Along with two of her friends who had also managed to free themselves, she ran for her life. But halfway down the street, she realized that her best friend, Azira Simmons, wasn't with them. Norwood ran back to the wreck and found Simmons slumped in the back seat. She wasn't moving, Norwood told Inside Edition. She threw open the back door and pulled her friend out, avoiding the broken glass as best she could. She dragged Simmons a few feet to safety and laid her on the ground. I checked her pulse, nothing. I put my hand against her chest, no sign of life. That's when I started CPR. Had the accident happened a few weeks earlier, she might not have known what to do. But Norwood, who wants to pursue a career in medicine, had earned her CPR certificate just the day before. Kneeling on the lawn and looking down at her dying friend, Norwood knew she had precious little time to practice what she learned. She started pumping Simmons' chest with her analog fingers and breathing into her friend's mouth in the hopes of filling her love with the kiss of life. No response. Then, after the 30th compression, Simmons began coughing and gasping for air. The CPR had worked. Soon paramedics arrived and rushed Simmons to the hospital, where she received stitches for a gash in her forehead. Then she heard how her best friend had saved her life. I wasn't shocked, Simmons told CNN. She will always help in any way she can. And there's two pictures of the girls, African-American, both of them very attractive teenagers. Speaking fluent fatherlish. Dads have a language all their own, one that's not difficult to decipher. Have you checked the oil in the car, my father used to say to me, his version of Hillel, hope you are well. Sometimes our phone calls would begin with an inquiry about the oil and end with an inquiry about the oil, with not a lot in between. Fathers have a lot of love to give, but it's often supplied through the medium of practical advice. In my experience, it's mostly about your motor vehicle. How's the car running? Did you get it serviced? How did you get that scrape on the side? My bomb of a student car, a battered green Toyota Corona, bought for $500, was the parchment upon which my father inscribed his paternal affections. I bet it's always been so. Back in ancient Rome, I bet the father would quiz his son on the state of his chariot. Are you keeping the oats up on the horses? Have you checked the spokes on the wheels? How did you get that scrape on the side? The father might then offer some help and advice about choosing togas. The trick is to buy high-quality gear and then look after it. That, my son, is true of clothing, chisels, tridents. Why can't father just say, I love you, or it's great to see you? The point is, that's exactly what we are saying. You just have to translate from language that is fatherlish. Listen closely enough, and the phrase, I love you, can be heard. The slightly lengthier, I could come around Saturday and place a silicone seal around the base of your toilet because I reckon that thing is getting really stinky. The sentiment. You made my life better from the moment you were born. May rarely be heard, but the gist is there and the more common. I'll hold the ladder while you get the leaves out of the gutter. And, I admire you, I really do, is mostly heard in the more idiomatic, there's no tread left in those tires. You need to run down to the garage first thing Monday. When I was 17, I went on my first road trip. A friend and I in that battered car. My father stood on the corner in the pre-dawn of a cold morning to bid us farewell. Highways are dangerous, he said, so don't try overtaking anything faster than a horse and buggy. Take a break every 2 hours, and every time you stop for gas, you really should check the oil. By the time we thought his speech was pretty funny and would chant, horse and buggy, every time I floored the accelerator to overtake some other speeding vehicle. Dad's long gone now, but after all those I realized that I had owned a copy of the Fatherless English Dictionary, I'd have understood that the speech my friend and I so casually mocked was simply Dad's attempt at affection. Rethink the pumpkin, and this is just right for Halloween. You probably carved your pumpkins the same way for decades, cutting off the top and hauling the innards first, right? Boo! This year, keep the top attached and wait until you're done carving your masterpiece before scooping the seeds. You'll have more control over your design cutting into a solid, intact pumpkin, and then you can even grab the stem to use as leverage. Living up your bathroom. Rooms with limited windows, such as bathrooms, are great for privacy, but bad for plants. Or are they? Light is scarce, and moisture is ample on the forest floor, too. Try plants that thrive on there. Cast iron plants, Chinese evergreens, and snake plants. Wide leaves trap even dim sunlight, and pots can be as big or small as needed to fill your tiniest room. Plus, unlike your mirror, they'll love humidity from steamy showers. Tech. Filter spam textures. To avoid annoying spam text, iPhone users can go to Settings and select Messages, Filter Unknown Senders. Android users open Messages and click on the three dots in the upper right corner, then tap Settings, Spam Protection, Enable Spam Protection. Text from unsaved numbers go to a separate hidden inbox. Just switch back if you expect to hear from a new friend. Number 4. Keep pots from boiling over. Cooking. Take your tie off the pasta pot for 1 second. You might return to find water boiling over the side. Avoid a messy stovetop by sticking a toothpick laid flat between the lid and the pot. This small gap lets steam escape, which prevents the pots from boiling over, so you don't have to maintain constant vigilance. Because, you know, a watch pot and all that. Remove deodorant stains. If you put on a fresh shirt only to discover a telltale streak of white deodorant residue, don't despair. Just rub another article of clothing, a shirt or a sock, for instance, against it to transfer the stain. If you're already out when you notice a smudge, the sleeve or an inside area of your shirt will do. The food on your plate. I am coconut, a killer nut, not even close. In 2010, Barack Obama was to pay a visit to Mumbai's Gandhi Museum, where palm trees full of me dotted the grounds. The president knew me well. Coconuts are a part of life in Indonesia, where he spent his boyhood. A later video of him and Laos, coolly sipping my sweet water straight from my green shell, as if he'd done it 1,000 times, became a popular meme. Yet before his visit, Indian authorities methodically moved every last sign of me from the premises. Why? They were afraid the President of the United States would be taken out by one of me falling on his head. Let's get this out of the way. My rep as the killer fruit of countless innocents was then and still is a myth. A repeatedly misinterpreted 1984 study greatly exaggerated the number of deaths I caused by beaning, and the vicious rumors spread. Today, the only thing about me to die for are the sometimes too delicious foods you humans make with me, which include macaroons, pina coladas, rich curries, and custardy pies. A decade ago, Health Nuts briefly gave me a halo because some of my saturated fats called medium-chain triglycerides may raise beneficial HDL cholesterol. But ask a heart doctor today and they'll say, tell you that coconut oil will raise your bad LDL cholesterol as much as it'll raise HDL. Death by coconut indeed. You have other wrong ideas about me. I never look brown and hairy on the tree, despite what cartoons might have you believe. In my whole form, I'm smooth and green, yellow, orange, pink, or even sometimes red. And you think I'm a nut, but I'm actually a drupe, a fleshy fruit with a single seed in the center, as is a cherry, an apricot, or a peach. And even if you already knew that botanical factoid, you're likely mistaken about what part of me you're eating. Picture a young coconut. You know, the green things that get hacked open with a machete so that you or the president can drink the water within? That green part is my skin, and the fibrous beige stuff hacked through is my flesh. Essentially an incredible husk. Inside that is the shell of my seed, within which you'll find the nutrients of my endosperm. When I'm young, that endosperm is mostly water, the sweet, vaguely nutty juice that since 2004 has been bottled and sold across the United States, and is now a $5 billion industry worldwide. As I grow, solids start depositing on my shell's inside surface, until little water is left, and there's lots of firm, white, jelly-like flesh ready to eat. So the brown, hairy coconuts you see at the store aren't me. They're my seeds. I'm native to very warm, humid coastal locations in India, Thailand, Sri Lanka, the Philippines, and Indonesia. Of course, but I'd like to go back further in America than previously thought. For the longest time, anthropologists and historians believed that the only way early humans could have made it to the Americas was via ice bridges connecting Russia to Alaska. But recent theories propose that intrepid migrants from Polynesia got there by sea, likely with heavy reliance on me. And no wonder. I'm a long-lasting source of food and water, and my fibrous flesh is used to make rope, mats, mattress, stuffing, and fishing nets. My shell can be burned into charcoal for fire or used as a bowl or musical instrument. My leaves are used for thatching roofs and making brooms and baskets, while my trunks are used for building houses, boats, and drums. My tree roots have an array of folk medicinal uses and produce pigments that become dyes, and their frayed ends have even been repurposed as toothbrushes. With all that, you can imagine how coconut-rich cultures could thrive and spread across vast ocean distances. Let me leave with a sweeter presidential wave. A World War II naval patrol boat commanded by one John F. Kennedy was destroyed in 1943 by a Japanese warship. JFK and his survivor crew were stranded on an island and quickly running out of options. They were hungry, thirsty, and nurturing industries when they encountered two friendly native coast watchers. JFK scratches the message in a coconut shell. Naro Isle, commander, native knows position. He can pilot. 11 alive. Need small boat. Kennedy. The Coast Watchers delivered this to Allied forces, who managed to stage a rescue and get the crew back. Years later, Judge Ernest W. Gibson, Jr., a colonel in the South Pacific during the war, gave the coconut shell to the newly elected president, who had turned it into a paperweight. It sat on his desk in the Oval Office throughout his presidency, and now is the centerpiece of the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston, as proof that we coconuts don't take lives, we save them. Soft and tender coconut macaroons. Preheat the oven to 350 degrees Fahrenheit and line a rimmed baking sheet with parchment. In a mixing bowl, stir together one 14-ounce bag of sweetened flaked coconuts with one 5.4-ounce canned coconut cream, 5 fluid ounces of evaporated milk, half a teaspoon of vanilla extract, and a pinch of salt until thoroughly combined. Fold in the stiffly beaten egg whites of 2 large eggs. It's okay if the eggs mostly deflate during folding. Using clean hands, form the coconut mixture into mounds the size of your choice, about 20 golf ball-sized mounds. and arrange on the prepared baking sheet. Bake, rotating the sheet front to back once halfway through, until the macaroons are deep golden brown all over, about 35 minutes. Let cool on the baking sheet, then transfer to an airtight container and store at room temperature. And with that appetizing thing, let's switch over to Consumer Reports and talk about the quest for safer chicken. Why are potentially deadly bacteria legally allowed in our poultry? And how can you or family stay safe? Amanda Creighton used to love cooking, especially big Sicilian dinners prepared for her extended family, relishing the family bonding as much as the food. But that changed in 2013 after Creighton's son and mother-in-law became seriously ill with Salmonella Heidelberg, a virulent antibiotic resistant strain of bacteria that was traced to chicken from Foster Farms, a leading poultry processor. The cannabinoid chicken was part of a Salmonella outbreak that spanned 16 months and sickened 634 people across the country, more than a third of whom had to be hospitalized. And for Creighton's family in Arizona, the consequences were devastating. Her mother-in-law had recently received a diagnosis of an aggressive form of cancer. When she developed a salmonella infection, she experienced a fever and gastrointestinal symptoms so severe she had to postpone chemotherapy. She died of cancer a year later, says Creighton, who added that she still wonders whether the delay in treatment played a role. Shortly after her mother-in-law's bout with salmonella, Creighton's son Noah, then 17 months old, also developed a fever. Although he regularly shared meals with his grandmother, the family's pediatrician ruled out the salmonella because Noah's didn't have the serious gastrointestinal symptoms, Creighton says. But Noah's condition only worsened. At night, he would wake up every 4 or 5 hours just screaming with a fever of 103.5 when the Motrin or the Tylenol were off, Creighton remembers. Desperate, Creighton finally took Noah to the hospital, where an MRI revealed a life-threatening brain abscess that required emergency surgery. Testing showed that the abscess was caused by the same strain of salmonella that had sickened Noah's grandmother, according to a lawsuit the family won against Foster Farms. Noah is now a happy, outgoing 9-year-old, Creighton says, but the infection has long-term repercussions. He is left with a brain injury affecting his vision, speech, learning, memory, and behavior. Though the Creightons have a fund from their verdict that helped cover Noah's medical care, it remains a struggle to get him all the therapy he needs. Lethal but legal bacteria. Caring for Noah is not the only battle Creighton continues to fight. She has also become an advocate for food safety, serving on the board to stop foodborne illness, a nonprofit group in her role. In her role there, she has learned just how vulnerable consumers are to dangerous bacteria in their food. That includes not just Salmonella, but also Campylobacter. Together, those two bacteria sicken almost 1.9 million each year, hospitalizing 28,000 and killing about 450. Cannabinated chicken is often responsible. While Salmonella can be spread through many foods, poultry is a leading source. In fact, chicken and turkey account for about a fifth of the Salmonella breakout infections, according to 2018 estimates. For Campylobacter-related infections, chicken and turkey make up an even higher percentage, a full two-thirds. Most alarming to Creighton, those illnesses don't stem from the unlawful distribution of contaminated chicken. Instead, under rules set by the Department of Agriculture, poultry processors can legally distribute their products even if they know they may contain harmful bacteria. The USDA, in fact, allows a 9.8% of whole chickens in a test to be contaminated with Salmonella. The percentage is even higher for chicken parts, 15.4%, and ground chicken, 25%. Campylobacter, too, is allowed in poultry, 15.7% samples for whole chickens, 7.7% for parts, and 1.9% for ground. The USDA says it sets those standards based on a risk assessment process that estimates the Salmonella and Campylobacter percentages need to meet national public health goals. Foster Farms says in 2014, after the outbreak that sickened the Creighton family, it took steps to reduce contamination and committing to limited salmonella to 5% or less of its whole chicken and chicken parts. The poultry industry overall has invested $1 million to improve safety, says Ashley Peterson, Ph.D., Senior Vice President of Scientific and Regulatory Affairs at the National Chicken Council, an industry group and she says about 90% of chicken processing plants are meeting and exceeding present USDA standards for salmonella on whole chicken and chicken parts. Salmonella and Campylobacter by the numbers. 51% of bacterial foodborne illnesses in the U.S. come from those two pathogens. The bacteria sickened a lot of people each year, 1.9 million, 28,000 hospitalizations, and 450 deaths. And chicken and turkey count for 21% of salmonella illnesses and 67% of Campylobacter illnesses. Indeed, last year, 8% of chicken samples overall tested by the USDA had salmonella. CR's 2018 test of chicken had similar results, with 9% of the samples testing positive for salmonella, down from 11% in 2013. Zero tolerance. Food safety advocates say, however, that even 8% translates into a lot of potentially dangerous chicken. Consider that U.S. farmers produce about 45 billion pounds of chicken in 2020, and if 8% were contaminated, that means they distributed about 3.6 billion pounds of salmonella-laden chicken. That's why CR, along with the Center for Science for Public Interest, the Consumer Federation of America, and Stop Foodborne Illness, recently urged the USDA to lower the percentage of poultry samples allowed to test positive for salmonella and Campylobacter. They especially want the agency to more forcefully regulate the most dangerous strains of salmonella. The focus shouldn't be only on prevalence, but also on how many people get ill from a strain and how viral it is, says Brian Holmholm, CR's Director of Food Policy and a former Deputy Undersecretary for Food Safety at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Some of the most worrisome strains cause infections that are difficult to treat with antibiotics. All told, about 1 in 6 salmonella infections and nearly 1 in 3 Campylobacter infections are caused by bacteria resistant to antibiotics used to treat serious infections. For the most dangerous type of salmonella, the USDA should strive for a zero-tolerance policy, Ron Holmes says. That's what the agency did in the 1990s with E. coli, a deadly strain of the bacteria designated an adulterant in ground beef. As a result, beef with the strain can no longer be legally sold. And after that change, the number of people sickened by that type of bacteria was cut almost in half. Salmonella infections in humans, on the other hand, have remained largely unchanged over the past 20 years. And the percentage of salmonella detected in retail chicken resistant to multiple antibiotics had increased from 15% in 2015 to 42% in 2020, according to preliminary government data. For now, the burden of producing salmonella and Campylobacter infections falls heavily on consumers, who urge to cook poultry thoroughly to kill the pathogens. Peterson of the National Chicken Council told CR that proper handling and cooking of poultry is one thing that will eliminate any risk of foodborne illness. But the responsibility for preventing salmonella and Campylobacter infection shouldn't resist on home cooks, Amanda Cratton says. Unfortunately, I now have to handle chicken like tostic wakes, and that's all I should have to cook in my kitchen. Hatch a healthy egg. To reduce the amount of contaminated poultry, advocates say other changes are needed too, starting long before chickens reach the processing plants. And the vast majority of the roughly 9 billion chickens raised for food in the U.S. each year begin their lives in facilities run by a handful of companies that breed the hens and hatch the eggs. The chicks then go to grow houses until they're ready to be shipped for slaughter, processing, and packaging. Turkeys are produced in a similar way. Given how consolidated the poultry system is, any bacteria the chicks carry can be widely distributed. One example is a recent outbreak of Salmonella hardar linked to ground turkeys, says Thomas Gramillion, Director of Food Policy at Consumer Federation of America. Investigators found evidence of the outbreak across the country. Where did it come from, he says? Everywhere. And why? Because this highly consolidated, highly integrated system has got problems at the top. But trying to fix problems at the top in the hatcheries and farms is difficult, in part because the USDA oversight there is limited. The government has some jurisdiction in those locations through a branch called the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service. But APHIS's focus is animal health, not human health. As a result, those farms more aggressively vaccinate hens against salmonella strains that sicken birds rather than humans. The U.S. oversight from meat safety doesn't start until the kitchens reach the slaughterhouse, when the agency's Food Safety and Inspection Service enters the scene. But at that point, Ron Holmes says, the salmonella is already out of the barn, no pun intended. Michael Teller, a former acting undersecretary for food safety at the USDA and a current board member at Stop Foodborne Illness, agrees. The USDA should have full regulatory authority at the farm. The lack of accountability at that stage is a problem. Broadening the USDA's authority, though, is unlikely, at least in the short term, because that would require action by Congress. So Taylor says processors need to be more demanding of the companies that supply them with the birds. That means, for example, requiring proof that the suppliers vaccinated the birds and included probiotics in their feed, which can help keep bad bacteria from populating their intestines. They should also test more of the chickens when they arrive at the slaughterhouse and reject birds contaminated with dangerous bacteria. Evidence from the European Union shows that better care for birds resulted in less bacteria in meat. Between 2005 and 2006, almost a quarter of the flocks in the EU tested positive for salmonella. A decade later, after farmers were required to adopt strict hygiene measures, just 3% did. Having chickens arrive at the processing plant healthy might reduce reliance on some controversial practices, such as dipping chicken in chlorine or other antimicrobial forces, a practice that is banned in the EU. Processes can do better, too. Once birds enter their slaughterhouses, this includes ensuring that workers practice scrupulous hygiene, as well as sterilized defeathering machines and conveyor belts. In addition, FICS could use authority more aggressively in processing plants. Rhonholm, for example, says that when companies exceed allowed limits for contaminated poultry, the FSIS is essentially giving them a warning by asking them to develop a plan to make corrections. But each day the problem remains unfixed, more potentially contaminated chicken is distributed. At the very least, the FSIS should act quickly against these poor-performing plants, Rhonholm says. That can even mean withholding the USDA-inspected seal, which would make selling the poultry illegal. Without a meaningful threat, companies often aren't motivated to improve as quickly, he says. When outbreaks do occur, the USDA should have more power to compel recalls. Currently, it must rely on companies to voluntarily recall their products, and most, of course, resist. One reason recalls are so difficult to trigger is that the USDA must genetically match the bacteria making people sick to a particular product. Such proof is hard to come by because it can require finding an unopened package of meat containing the outbreak strain of the home of an ill person. Such investigations can also be time-consuming. In October of 2013, during the outbreak that sickened the Cretans, Sierra called for a recall of Foster Farms chicken after we found salmonella matching the outbreak strain in a sample of the company's chicken. But the chicken was not recalled until July 2014. Prospect for change. New leadership at the USDA may signal a willingness to make changes. Sandra Eskin, who became Deputy Undersecretary for Food Safety at the agency early this year, after decades of public interest organizations, told CR, it's time to consider how we can effectively bring down these illnesses by incentivizing measures that can reduce contamination all along the farm-to-work continuum. But the poultry industry remains largely resistant to change, especially on the farm. Mike Roback, a microbiologist and former executive of Cargill, a global supplier to the poultry industry, says that the focus should remain on processing plants and not in trying to eliminate specific strains of salmonella. Peterson at the National Chicken Council says that no one wants to reduce these pathogens more than the companies producing our food, but there is no silver bullet that will totally eradicate salmonella and campylobacter. Rhonholm at CR notes that it is in the industry's best interest to act. Producers want to put out a good, safe product, and their brand is on the line. Indeed, protecting reputation can be a powerful motivator. For example, Foster Farms invested more than $75 million in food safety after the salmonella outbreak involved in the Cretans case. But it shouldn't take an outbreak, Rhonholm does. We need more consumer understanding the risk and calling for change, demanding more to be done to eliminate the deadly bacteria in our kitchen. Creighton, for one, is ready. Although she participates in programs teaching members of the public how to prepare food safely, she hopes that meat suppliers, government, and safety advocates can act soon to reduce harmful bacteria in meat. Consumers, she says, shouldn't have to treat food like a biohazard. Cutting boards, wood or plastic. Food safety experts used a warning against wooden cutting boards, saying they were more likely to harbor bacteria than plastic ones. But newer research shows that both kinds can be safe if you follow three simple themes. Use at least two. Designate one for raw meat, poultry, and fish, and the other for fruits and vegetables. That helps prevent cross-contamination. Clean thoroughly. Both wash types with hot, soapy water. Plastic boards can even go in the dishwasher. Periodically sanitize your boards by flooding the surface with a diluted meat solution, 1 gallon of water mixed with 1 tablespoon of bleach, then rinsing with plain water. Always dry cutting boards completely before storing them, so moisture-loving bacteria have less opportunity to grow. Know when to buy a new board. Over time, any cutting board can develop deep scratches or grooves that may track bacteria, which could then spread to your food. So swap damaged old boards for new ones. Stock sickness starting with the egg. Preventing chickens from being contaminated with Salmonella and Campylobacter and from spreading the bacteria to humans needs to start before the chicks are hatched and continue after they have been slaughtered. The hatchery. Breeder hens can spread bacteria to eggs and chicks. Better vaccinate hens against Salmonella strains that sicken humans. Add probiotics and about probiotics to feed to encourage the growth of good bacteria in chickens' guts. Practice scrupulous hygiene. Prevent overcrowding of birds. Decontaminate workers' clothing and equipment. Limit personnel who handle birds and keep feed and water clean. The farm. Crowded chickens where chicks are raised to create a fertile breeding ground for bacteria. Isolate birds that carry harmful bacteria. Test more birds when they arrive and reject contaminated ones. And the processing plant. Bacteria can spread when chicken is prepped for shipment to grocery stores and elsewhere as whole birds or parts. Test more birds when they arrive and reject contaminated ones. Improve processing, cleanly separate intestines for meat, and regularly disinfect defeathering machines, conveyor belts, and other equipment. Inspect more slaughtered chickens and destroy meat with dangerous bacteria or send it to facilities that cook chicken before selling it. Six essential meat safety tips. Until regulations change, consumers need to be extra careful and assume that any type of raw poultry or meat could contain disease-causing bacteria. To stay safe, take these steps while preparing and cooking poultry. Start at the supermarket. When buying poultry and meat, use a plastic bag provided by many markets to keep the juices from spreading to other items in your cart. If it's hot, take an insulated bag and use ice or an ice pack. Store carefully. Put meat in the fridge or freezer as soon as you get it home. Keep it wrapped tightly or store it in containers that prevent its juices from leaking onto other foods. Place it on a bottom shelf. That way, if leakage does occur, it won't spill down into lower shelves. Clean up any messes quickly. Thaw safely. Defrost in the refrigerator rather than on the counter. Bacteria multiply fast at temperatures between 40 degrees and 140 degrees Fahrenheit, and counter-thawed food is likely to reach that danger zone. If you're short on time, you can defrost meat in a microwave. Don't rinse. People think they have to wash or rinse chicken before they cook it for many reasons, because their mom did it. They think they need to remove slime or blood, or they think it's safer, says Samzi Rogers, Ph.D., Director of Food Safety and Research at Consumer Reports. But that doesn't improve taste and, in fact, may increase your chances of getting a foodborne illness by splashing bacteria around your sink, countertops, and nearby utensils or dishes. A Department of Agriculture study found that 60% of people who washed or rinsed their bird had bacteria in their sink afterward, and that 14% still had it there after cleaning the sink. The lesson? Don't rinse your chicken. Wash your hands often. Wash your hands for 20 seconds with soapy water after each time you handle raw meat, poultry, or seafood. Also remember to scrub hands between food prep and cleanup to avoid spreading bacteria throughout your kitchen or home. And cook properly. You can't tell whether meat is done by looking at it or touching it, Roger says. Use a meat thermometer and cook all poultry, whole parts or ground, to 165 Fahrenheit. For beef, pork, and lamb, the safe internal temperature is 145 degrees Fahrenheit. For roast steaks and chops, 160 degrees Fahrenheit for ground meat. Road report. The simple fix to bright and dim headlights. Over time, headlights can become yellow or cloudy due to normal exposure to the elements, and that can hinder nighttime visibility. To fix this, either replace your headlight lenses or restore them using a restoration kit, $10 to $20. Do-it-yourself kits help you sand off the old, damaged lens coating and apply a new protective coating. The kits require a bit of elbow grease and sometimes a drill with a sanding disc attachment for buffing. Some body shops will do the restoration for $70 to $150, depending on the model. Based on our experience, the hazing effect will eventually return with either method, typically becoming noticeable within a year. Should I buy my leased vehicle? If you're at the end of your lease, it could be a smart move to buy the vehicle from your financing company. Most leases include a buyout option at the end of the term for a preset price calculated years earlier when the agreement was first signed. That price is likely to be less than your car's retail value today. With used car prices up almost 30% over the last 2 years, normally a lease buyout hasn't often been a good deal, but a tight supply of vehicles due to a shortage of microchips needed for new cars and increased demand in prices. First drive on the 2022 Honda Civic. The 2022 Civic has spread the the broad demeanor of past models, adding agility and nicer interior to details. It's also roomier than most compact sedans and better equipped, particularly the top touring trim. See our take. The car takes a strong first impression. The up-level 180-horsepower 1.5-liter turbo four-cylinder engine generates enough off-the-line thrust and the handling feels responsive for the class, even if the ride skews a bit firm. As with previous model years, it can be challenged to get in and out of this low-slung sedan. The price ranges from $21,700 to $28,300. Destination charges of $1,000 and prices driven $29,295. The vital statistic, $96. The median dollar amount the CR members saved by haggling over the price of a set of four new tires. Only 14% chose to negotiate, but when they did, it resulted in a lower price 70% of the time. General Motors. GM was calling 282,429 vehicles from the 2021 model year because of faulty software that can prevent the airbag warning light from working properly. As a result, drivers may think the airbag is working when it's not, potentially leading to inadequate protection in a crash. The recall includes the Buick Envision, Cadillac CT4, CT5, Escalade and Escalade ESV, Chevrolet Corvette, Tahoe, Suburban, GMC Yukon, and Yukon XL. What to do? Software can be updated over the air or at a dealership at no cost. For more information, go to my.gm.com/recalls. Track intelligence. How to prevent car thefts. Car theft increased 9.2% last year, according to the National Insurance Crime Bureau, an industry membership organization. The NICB says economic stress due to the pandemic and social and public safety resource limitations may have helped drive the increase, also probably the rise in value of cars. Lieutenant Bruce Hosea, an auto theft specialist with the Los Angeles Police Department, tells CR that much of the increase in thefts we've seen involves cars deemed easy marks by criminals, older models without anti-theft technology, and cars with keys and fobs left inside. At the same time, police say some thieves have become tech-savvy, using electronic tools to steal vehicles without damaging windows, locks, or steering columns. Below are tips on how to keep your car from becoming a target and how to save on the insurance processes. Smart parking. Simple habits can make a big difference. Never leave your unattended vehicle unlocked or running, and try to park in busy, well-lit areas. The overwhelming majority of vehicle thefts and burglaries are results of unlocked vehicle doors, says Crystal Clark, a spokesperson for the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office in Florida. Double-check that you have the key or fob with you and stow valuables out of sight to discourage smash-and-grab thefts. Add locks and alarms. Police says visible steering wheel locks, such as the club and dislock, work well as deterrents, and adding an aftermarket alarm system, which often includes a visible blinking red light, can be a good idea for older vehicles without built-in systems. Auto security company Vox Electronic Corps sells alarm usually costs $300 to $700, plus $200 to $600 for professional installation, depending on the features and the systems. Alarms can be also added to new cars. Install lights at home. Lighting can be an effective theft deterrent, especially if you park in your driveway, says Captain Martin Rodriguez of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. He recognizes motion detection lights, which can startle a would-be thief and alert those at the home. Doorbell cameras such as Google Nest, Hello, and Ring can help police identify suspects. Also remember to store keys in the house. Never leave them in the car or in the garage. Track your car. Aftermarket tracking systems will prevent theft, but they can help find your car after the fact. Some basic GPS devices plug into your vehicle's computer port, but they can also be easily removed. More complex, integrated systems such as LoJack require professional installation. Some recent car models provide tracking through subscription-based services. For example, GM's OnStar offers a plan that costs $30 per month with stolen vehicle assistance. Save on insurance. Some insurance companies offer discounts for cars with anti-theft devices, usually up to 15% off. Comprehensive coverage and discounts can vary based on where you live and the insurer says. Loretta Waters, Vice President of the Insurance Information Institution. Waters said outfitting your vehicle with an alarm, GPS, tracking, and a hidden ignition switch, kill switch, that prevents the car from starting, even with a key, can often qualify you for a discount. Now, I'm going to do something I don't normally do. I have a review here for the new Chevrolet Corvette, and I don't normally read these reviews because they're not really of interest to a lot of our members. But let's face it, most of us have always dreamed of owning a Corvette. and they give it a breathtaking performance, but it only gets a 68 overall score. Gets a road test score of 97, however. The highs are acceleration, handling, braking, transmission, fit, and finish. The lows, the access, obviously it's hard to get into, rear and side visibility. The powertrain they tested was a 495 horsepower, 6.2 liter V8 engine, 8-speed dual-clutch automatic transmission with rear-wheel drive, 19 miles per gallon on freemium, which isn't bad. The price anywhere from $60,000 to $79,000, and 680S tested. With great anticipation, we finally bought and tested the redesigned Corvette Stingray with its new rear mid-engine layout, a configuration long favored by Ferrari, Lamborghini, and other exotic sports car companies. We're impressed by the Corvette's performance numbers and thrilled with its fun-to-drive nature. But despite the super high road test score, we can't recommend the new Corvette because it and Chevrolet's inconsistent reliability history. Showcased under the glass rear hatch is a 6.2-liter V8. There's no turbocharger or hybrid electric assist here, just 495 unadulterated horsepower, coupled with an 8-speed dual-clutch automatic that clicks off shifts in rapid-fire manner. The Thunder's engine sounds glorious. We clocked the Corvette at 3.4 seconds from 0 to 60 miles per hour, beating the Tesla Model S PB85D as the quickest car we've ever tested. Handling agility is superb, thanks to immediate turn-in response from the nearly telepathic steering and barely a trace of body roll. Our vet was so controllable at its limits that it shouldn't scare off less skilled drivers. Even with its otherworldly performance, the ride from the optimal adaptive system is civilized in the tour setting. As with other sports cars, there are compromises. It's so low that getting in and out could count as your daily yoga routine. Side and rear visibility are practically non-existent, and the long line of climate control buttons perched on the ledge are difficult to use. We're dismayed that FCW and AEB with pedestrian detection aren't available, and that BSW and RCTW aren't standard on all trims. And with that glorious review, we have time for one more joke. Outside the ladies' men's room of a Texas steakhouse, I find a confused and anxious young woman who sighed with relief when she saw me. "Oh, I'm so glad you're here," she said. "I was afraid to enter. I didn't know if it was a steer or a heifer." Oh, let's do one more. During the month of October, our local barbershop offers a discount for children if they come in wearing a Halloween costume. I suggested to my 5-year-old that he go dressed in a Spider-Man outfit. "Oh, I can never do that," he said. "Then everyone would know that I am Spider-Man." And with that, we'll speed through our clothes just like a Corvette. We've run out of time for today's episode of Renew Digest Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so very much for listening.